Hi, welcome to the Professionals Playbook. I'm Justin Lee, a former F-16 and current F-35 fighter pilot. My guest today is Ron Montgomery, who served as a U.S. Navy SEAL for 26 years. Before we get to a highlight, as a side note, if you know anyone that would be a great guest on the show, email me, justin@professionalsplaybook.com. Also try to answer any questions that you send that way. Many of you already have, but ways to help are 1, write a review on iTunes, 2, subscribe to the show, and 3, share it with as many people as possible. All right, here's a brief highlight from our conversation today.
If you're going to do a true halo jump, you're going to be at some altitude, maybe even 30 grand. And of course, once they open the bird up and it's not pressurized, you got to find something to breathe. Well, first you have to pre-breathe. When you pre-breathe on oxygen, you bring your partial pressure, O2, up to what the flight surgeon says it should be. And then you leave with nothing but a little bailout bottle. And you only need to breathe for a short time until you get down there in thicker atmosphere. But it's cold, it's miserable. You wouldn't make a halo jump if you weren't carrying equipment. Carrying equipment is cold and miserable. Openings are rougher. It's a real working evolution.
Mr. Montgomery completed basic underwater demolition SEAL training at the age of 18 and served as enlisted man for 16 years before accepted a commission as a SEAL warrant officer. His first SEAL command was SEAL Team 2. During that time, he became a member of the Shooting Stars, the East Coast Navy parachute team. He then returned to Coronado as a BUDS instructor. During his career, he served in many of the East Coast teams, as well as the U.S. Navy SEAL anti-terrorism team. He also spent a tour as the tactics officer for the Naval Security Coordination Team, known as Red Cell. Red Cell members demonstrated the vulnerabilities of military bases and would use false IDs, jump fences, barricade buildings, take hostages, kidnap high-ranking officers and admirals, plant bombs near Air Force One, sneak into submarine bases, and more. Without further ado, Ron Montgomery.
So what I want to talk about is BUDS training, but I don't want to really talk about it from the perspective of the person actually going through. You're an instructor there, so I'm curious of how that mindset is in the days leading up to getting a new class. So if you wouldn't mind talking about that as well as what BUDS is.
The BUDS instructors are like any other military group. They train to a plateau, and then as they continue on, their skills erode or certain things erode. So in between a class, you may have to go in and present some classes to make sure you haven't wandered from the curriculum. The actually preparing for the incoming flux of people isn't that difficult. That's a fairly well-oiled machine. Everybody knows that a bunch of young people of various backgrounds is going to show up on their door, and we have to do something with them. And we have the assets to birth them and feed them and keep control of them. So preparing for it is a repetitive cycle that you become pretty smooth at, actually.
How often are you in a new class?
We did 3 a year. I'm not sure if they're doing more a year now or not. It's kind of unfair to say we do 3 training periods a year or any number of training periods a year, because the students that come in don't always start on the class that they expect to start on. There's a physical test that has to be given prior to the class starting. Actually, I was pretty fortunate when I got there. I had been in aid school up in the Great Lakes during the winter, and I never considered myself a real athlete. I'm not saying I didn't have certain hand and eye coordination, but nothing that would make me stand out from a group, I don't believe. But when I came back from A school, I was really out of shape. A school, mm-hmm. From Machinesmith A school in Great Lakes, Illinois. It's your initial training, like where you would expect to get your Naval Enlisted Code or in the Army, your MOS. So for me, I went to A school. I went to boot camp, then I went to A school to be a machinesmith. Okay. Which I never did, because when I first got to the team, they said, "What are you?" And I said, "A machinist, mate." They said, "Well, you don't sound very happy about it." I said, "Well, I really wanted to be an engineman." They said, Santu, you're an engineman. What do we care?" So, but very often you end up there and you go to that screening test on Friday and you fail. But we already know a lot of people are going to fail that screening test because they've come from all over the Navy. So they put you in a 3-month program, and all you do is work out half a day and clean up half a day. So you'll start your day out in the gym or on a run or whatever, and an instructor will loosely monitor you because you have to grow up and motivate yourself to get into the shape you need to get through the initial screening test so you can start training. So I for most people, you know, you can tag another 3 months on there.
Okay. And so I guess day one, what are you thinking as an instructor? Are you trying to weed out the weakest ones?
No, we already know that it's not required of us to try to weed out anybody. There are going to be 100, 120 young men that show up, and you won't have time to get to know any of them. In the first 2 weeks, you'll probably be down to 40 people. So the Buds is very impersonal for the first training session. There's two groups. There's kids like myself that showed up at 17, 18 years old, dumb as a hoe handle, come from a small town, never been out in the big world, and all these people were screaming at them. Well, you've been taught, or at least in the rural areas where I was from, to respect authority and try to accomplish whatever it is they wish you to accomplish. A lot of people aren't like that, and they just say no. And we have no huge process for somebody leaving. We have a bell. You go over and ring the bell. An instructor in the instructor hut will hear it. He'll walk out and he'll say, "You sure you want to do this, son?" And he'll talk to you for a few minutes, and then it's your decision. And then they whisk away. They just, I don't know, they vanish. They're like beamed away. I don't know where they go.
What's that talk like when you're, have you been the guy talking to a guy that wants to quit?
Yes. Surprisingly, on both ends of the spectrum, on day 1 through 10 or 15. And, you know, you just try to get an idea of is this a good kid? What's your reason for quitting? We haven't done anything really that hard. And young people look at the too much at the big picture. In reality, you just have to do what's coming up next, do it well, and then try to get prepared for the next evolution. But on the other end, in second phase, we have three phases. Second and third phase flip-flops all the time. One's explosives and one's diving. Explosives land warfare. The other one is diving. But whichever one he was in at the moment said he's going to quit. I says, "I don't understand that. You're doing well in the class. You know, you're middle of the pack. You do well academically. Why would you want to quit?" And he says, I realize this isn't what I want to do for a living. And I said, "If you quit, you will forever think of yourself as a quitter. You can't do that. You're too valuable." So he says, "Okay." And there's one young man out there that went all the way to the end of Bud's training and just before graduation quit.
Oh, wow.
And he went through because I told him he would think he was a quitter if he did. I've heard stories of such nonsense, but that's the first time I ever experienced it. I wasn't sure whether I felt good about it or bad about it.
So you get people that quit from day one to the last day.
To the last day.
I can't believe people would quit on day one. That's incredible to me.
It's not what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
Shoot, we had one class that only had three people. We call it the class that never was. And they rolled back. You know, you can't pay the taxpayer. You can't spend the taxpayer's money, you know, with a whole instructor staff. And there's these three guys. Yeah. So we rolled them back. I wasn't involved. They rolled them back to the class behind theirs, but they let them keep their class number.
Okay. Wow. Class of three. So you guys are the ones, as the instructors, walking around. I've seen videos with the bullhorn there in the water. Is the water the most challenging thing for people to get over?
No, it's all mental. The water is tough because there's an Arctic current that dips in there, and you will get hypothermia. We pull young people out with hypothermia all the time. And, you know, they have no body fat, and the water's really cold. But we throw them in a sauna and asked them a few questions. When they can figure out who the president is and what floor they live on, we're put them back in the water.
What do you think makes people thrive in that environment? Because you always hear about the football player who's, you know, 6'3", 200 pounds, and he quits, and then there's some, you know, scraggly guy that makes it all the way through.
We have people every size, every color, every race, every background. I don't care what it is. We are a cross-section of America. But the people that make it are the people that understand sacrifice. They may not understand it consciously, but subconsciously they do. If you get a gentleman in there and he's this massive football player, played in college, has never failed. I mean, he went through college. He's a young officer. On a side note, our officers are great. They get their butts kicked right along with us. And he's telling you how all the things he did that made him wonderful prior to coming there, now he's going to bowl through this thing. His body is his temple, and he's not likely going to sacrifice a body part to get a training task done. If you're not willing to sacrifice something to get a training task done, what would you sacrifice to get a real world event done? So it's the people that will sacrifice. And people that sacrifice are commonly wrestlers. They're always going up and down in weight. They're disciplined people, gymnasts. I'm not saying there's not a lot of big, burly guys. You know, I can remember at one time, SEAL 2, it looked like the whole place was an NFL team. But you can't have just one size, one type person. If you need to drop somebody through an air vent down into a room to perform a task, they're not going to be dropping me down through that air vent. So you got to have people in all shapes and all sizes.
Can you tell, I guess, day one when they show up by their body language, who's going to make it through?
Wow, I wish I could say I even had an inkling, but I do not. Now, the Navy thought they would embrace technology, and they would figure out what made all us young people click. So every Friday, they took blood, and they were going to figure out a way to only send the people to us that would, well, only is a big word. They were going to try to cut down our attrition rate significantly. All they ended up with like gallons of blood. They never figured anything out.
Do you guys ever drop people, or does everybody else have to drop themselves?
Yes. There are times, I hate to say this, some people are too stupid to quit and some people are too smart. We had a young man. He was brilliant. He was a brilliant lad. He was highly motivated. He was at surface. He was everything you could want in a young student. But, well, here's an example. I came in one day. We inspect the barracks every day. It's a military thing. We're not really too concerned. They keep it tidy and neat, but there's always something we can complain about, sand in the rails of the window or something. They're always dropping down and doing push-ups. And, you know, we inspect the inside of their belt buckles. And just let's start the day by causing some stress before they go to breakfast. And I walk into this room, and there's four men to a room. And all of a sudden, something dawns on me. There is something wrong in this room. So I check the little trays in the window and the lockers and their bunks. And I only have so much time I can spend in a room. So I had to leave. But I know there was something wrong. So they're not, bud students aren't allowed to walk. So when I went back over to the instructor hut, I'm having a cup of coffee and I'm watching the class leave to go to breakfast. And in the middle of the class, there's one guy. And he has one brilliantly bright, shiny boot and one old, dull, worn-out boot. And it turns out that this kid had polished both his left boots, and he had forced his feet into them to stand inspection. I mean, I had him do right face, left face, about face. There's something wrong with this kid. When it came to water competency drills, you throw him in the water and you instructor swims and holds his breath and he'll dive down. What I do is I count how many turns on the manifold it takes to shut the air off. Then I leave him alone, and he reaches back there and he fixes it. Then I dive down and I turn it to where it's just within two turns to turn off. And I come back up. Then I go down and I pull his face mask down and his mouthpiece out and pull a double hose regulator around and put it underneath the manifold and hook it on the J valve and pull his weight belt. And now he's down there floundering. But in very short order, they says, wait a minute, they taught me to do this. So they grab their weight belt, sit their knees on the, holding their breath, sit their knees on the floor of the pool, put the weight belt behind them, fix all their gear, flip it back over their back, you know, get everything ready, and they swim away. And that's the evolution. But this particular gentleman, well, there's just no way to describe it. I could not possibly describe how unusual his procedure for trying to get back his gear back together. And so I came to the surface and I said, you guys have got to see this. There is no way for me to explain this and no one's going to believe it. So everybody started, oh, Monty, you're being a little rough on the kid, aren't you? And they walk over there and they stick their face in the water and they said, this man's got to go. We're so sorry. We really, really liked him. We were all rooting for him. We would do anything for that kid, but you can't fix something that's natural to him.
Yeah, especially in water. It seems like water is unforgiving.
It is. That's the great thing about going through BUDS is nobody makes that on their own. I'd have never made it through BUDS without a gentleman named Bob Mackey out in Oklahoma. And you'd think a kid from the middle of Oklahoma wouldn't be able to swim. He could swim like a shark, but he couldn't get in the water. He had to tiptoe into the water. So every time we started on a swim, the whole class was ahead of us, and we had to make that distance up. But, you know, without his help, but he did not do drown proofing well, where they tie your hands and feet, throw you in the water. He would flex and just bloosh, straight to the bottom.
Seems like around water, it's really tough to stay calm when you think you might obviously drown. Is that something you kind of get used to throughout the course?
Absolutely. There are things that occur to your body that you have no control over. And one of them is after you work in the water long enough and you touch cold water, it starts pulling the blood back from your extremities and bringing it over to the middle of your body to protect yourself. And cold water, seals do not react to cold water the way most people do. Years ago, they asked SEAL Team to come down to Cape Canaveral and run a PT program for the astronauts. And it was done in water, and they had to, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but apparently if your spacesuit heater malfunctions, you get really cold. So they were doing these really cold operations. And then they were there about 20 days and they sent them all home because we were messing their baseline up. We didn't function the way we were supposed to function.
Jeez. Are there any techniques that you picked up for dealing with cold, or does it just suck? You have to push through it.
Just push through it. I mean, you can't let it get you down. Now, there are points that I don't care what happens. The human body is a human body, but there are limits you can push.
As an instructor, are you alongside them in the water as well, or are you just yelling at them with the bullhorn?
Both. It depends on the evolution. There's so many swimming evolutions and tower. You know, of course, we control them in the tower. We hold our breath. We go down to the bottom. We tap on the bottom bell. There's a diving bell down there. Student comes out, and then there's this nice cable with a nice smooth coating on it, and I'll take a hold of that cable and I'll start pulling myself up. And the training evolution is they need to know how to properly exhale on the way to the surface, because as the pressure decreases, the volume increases, and you either exhale or you blow a lung out. So we stay right above them and we maintain it and you know, take them up the line. Now, that water is not normally cold. It has had a runaway heater, and we had to stop the evolution because it put everybody to sleep.
Especially with the lack of sleep. How many hours are these guys getting to sleep?
it depends on how organized they are, a lot of it. Now, there's things they can't control. We'll have them out in the middle of the night doing whatever. They cannot control that. But they still have to get back, put their weapons away, get cleaned up for tomorrow morning, get the barracks cleaned up. You know, those are things that you have to do.
Are there big differences between classes, between the one that only graduated three and then others that graduate a lot more?
Every class has its personality. Every group of people is a mixture of people all trying to push the rope in the same direction, but they're all different. So some classes are very funny. There was a man that used to do the presidential boat crew and the celebrity boat crew, and he could do all these voices, and he would do all these voices of young people, the bud students, putting out to sea and going through the surf zone. And then, but you know, as an instructor, you still appreciate humor. I mean, yeah, it's serious and you have to train like you're going to fight, and we understand that, but still some of these classes are hilarious. The class before mine, class 61, as far as I know, was the first class, numbered classes. You got to remember, we come from the OSS, the Naval Underwater Demolition Units, the Scouts and Raiders, UDT, a number of groups that are all some way related to water.
Well, it seems like humor is probably a big thing for the classmates themselves as well. It seems like humor is a cure to the pain.
Yes. And the class before mine was first class to give the instructor staff a present. It's a bunch of dried up frogs at a pool table. The class after mine went to Tijuana, Mexico and bought a giant Creature of the Black Lagoon statue. It's still there today. They come up with very creative things. One of the things we have to do is we have to sing ditties. And every class made up songs. And someday, people have asked me many times, because when I was an instructor, I made everybody sing in the cattle car on our way to a dive or whatever. And I knew all those ditties. But it's pretty fun.
Did the students give any gifts to individual instructors? I know from a pilot training perspective, we give a hammer to the guy that hooked the most people.
The gentleman I was telling you about, Bob, that helped me get through training. And this is how mistaken instructors can be. They decided that he should drop out, that he should be moved away, along with nine other guys. There were 10 guys. The first thing they did is they told him that he had to go find a rock and he had to carry it everywhere he went and he had to polish it. So we went and got a little polished rock. No, it's not going to do it, boys. Better find something a little bigger. So we went and found a little bigger rock. It's difficult to polish a large rock, especially if you have no equipment to polish rocks with. So I said, let's cover it with paraffin. It's like kind of like polish. That's smooth. So after enough tries over the weekend and enough paraffin bought and a rock being big enough, they put a Chiquita banana on his helmet liner and they gave him this rock. And everywhere we went, we ran with that big rock. I'm sure they don't do this anymore. It's a different era. And we would be running the chow or whatever, and we'd just pass that rock up and down the ranks. Everybody would run with it for a little while. But the reason they decided Bob was not going to make a good team member was his manner of speech. Middle of Oklahoma, rancher, and he had this odd manner of speaking. It's something like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Yeah. Well, yeah, let's do it. You know? So everything he said, there was this kind of this stumble before he started. Actually, Bob was very, very intelligent, tough as nails. You would have had to kill him to get him out of there. So that's basically what they did. They took 10 people out and they had to PT and do these different evolutions. And, the person that got 10 points got to secure. But there were only 9 grain. Oh, you got to leave. Got to go back up to the barracks. But there were only 9 points possible. So there was puddles of sweat under these guys, and a number of them quit. Of course, Bob didn't quit. So, you know, they secured the evolution, and Bob came back, and they thought, wow, that kid's tough as nails.
Jeez. So what kind of product are you getting at the end of Buds?
Not me personally, but somehow our command ended up with a request from SpecWarCom, which is the headquarters out in Coronado, California. And I guess because I was a training officer is how I ended up with it. But they sent these questionnaires to all the training officers wanting to know what their end product was and what it was about them we did or didn't like and anything we thought that may help their training cycle. The long and the short of it is I had a platoon with all young guys except one master chief and myself. And so, you know, I told them, if you can't build a nation on the backs of these kids, you can't build a nation. Because there is nothing I would have done to that platoon or for that platoon that could have improved them. I mean, they had a great work ethic. They embraced technology. Us old guys don't embrace technology too much. My son sat down at the table last night and built a computer. I said, where'd you learn to do that? I said, oh, I don't know. Okay. And they were dedicated. Now, if there was anything I could do, is I would deflate their egos. I don't know if that's just a young characteristic. I did. I don't know how you get rid of it, because you can't work with somebody that doesn't have an ego and doesn't have an opinion. And, you know, you have to have somebody that's got a spark in their eye somewhere.
Yeah.
But I would really like them to tone it down.
same with the fighter pilot. Like, you have to have unwavering confidence, but you can't be arrogant. Otherwise, you can't work with other people.
Unwavering confidence. That's an excellent, that describes it to a T right there.
So after Buds, these guys aren't ready to go to combat, right? There's a lot more training to be done.
There's a lot more training to be done. Training never stops. When I went to my first team, there were 6 of us that went to SEAL Team 2. In those days, there were 98 SEALs on the East Coast, about 101 on the West Coast. So you couldn't hide in a group. You still can't hide in a group. And we had a gentleman there named Rudy Bosch. And Rudy Bosch, and you may have seen Rudy Bosch. He was the first 70-year-old SEAL on the first Survivor show. He's an outstanding Northeastern guy, just straight as an arrow. I could tell 1,000 hours of Rudy Bosch stories. But, hey, we made it. We're at the team, so we go on a run. We run the beach. We do PT. And we do PT, and we run the beach. And when we get back from the beach, you know, we're high on life. We're running down the beach, talking to each other, cruising along. We got back. Rudy was standing on the quarterdeck. Rudy had been in Scouts and Raiders. Rudy was not amused that he beat us back to the quarterdeck. And he ripped us a new one, saying, I will throw you out of this team if I beat any of you ever again on a run. Yes, Master Chief. So we still didn't realize it, but being a SEAL is more like being a monk. You just never get good enough. There's no way you can train for something and then even live in the environment for some years and think, that's it. I've learned enough. Mm-hmm. This is good enough. Yeah. Well, there is no good enough. So you always try to learn something from everybody you talk to and every course you go to. I don't care if you're a subject matter expert in it, you're going to learn something.
Yeah. Yeah. That's similar to being a fighter pilot. The work is never over. You're always getting a little bit better, but there's so much to get good at that you can spend a lifetime and you'll never get there.
Nope.
So how much time elapses from the end of Buds to when you show up to your SEAL team?
There's pipeline training, which the Navy calls pipeline training, which means you leave this command, you go to training, you go to the next command. Our pipeline training was jump school down at Fort Benning, Georgia. So we left Buds, checked into our commands, did a little administrative stuff, and then went down to Georgia and went to jump school. Then we came back. Now, they have a They have a set of training back then. It was called SEAL Tactical Training or something. They keep changing the name of it. But the bottom line is, yeah, you've done all this and we appreciate you being here. But now you have to learn our team tactics. You have to learn to do things the way we do it, because every platoon works on what their strong point is. I mean, if you go to an area and you get a target folder and the last platoon was a contingency platoon, now you're the contingency platoon, and it's got something in there about mortars, and you guys can't hit a bull in the butt with a banjo with a mortar, you're going to change that to a 50 cal or whatever you are good at, because it's not a contest. You don't go out and fight. You manage a conflict, and you don't bite anything that's going to rip your head off. And to do that, you have to know your skills, and that's the way teams are. So they sent us right up into Northern Virginia in the woods, and we lived up there in the woods for 3 months. And we got to where when we patrolled and it was night and you couldn't see the person in front of you, you would know that black hole where there is nothing, whether it's going to go left or right of a tree, because you know who you're following. And yeah, so you
guys are doing spin up training based on what the team is going to be doing right. Later in that year,
because teams are kind of assigned different sections of the world. And at that time now if there's a conflict, they share for several reasons. First of all, you've trained all your life to go. Second of all, you wouldn't put all your veterans on one coast. We're not really big enough to overrun anything. So you have to share assets and stuff.
So you graduate BUDS, you're going to this school. Is it multiple things or is it just what you're doing later in that year?
It can be multiple things. SEALs also have our submersible vehicles, SDVs. Boy, talk about cold, miserable. Those boys work really, really hard. You would have to go to SDV school to be a pilot or navigator. And so you may end up going, checking in at your command, going to jump school, then going to SDV school, which is a long school. I forget how long it is. And you go to SDV school. And then, like me, right after going to jump school, I went to Army Rigger School, became a Army Parachute Rigger. And then there is no specific pathway of training objectives to get from point A to point Z. What the team needs for your next deployment is going to be the next school you go to.
Okay. So yeah, I guess we call it needs of the Air Force. So you don't have a lot of say in what they're going to make you do.
No. I mean, they'll ask you, hey, you want to go to rigor school? No. Okay. Be there on Monday.
Yep. Things have not changed in the military. So you show up to your team and you've been through all this training, but it sounds like you're fresh meat. You're the new guy.
You still don't have your Budweiser, your SEAL Trident.
Oh, wow.
You get your SEAL Trident. You will get your SEAL Trident if you go through SDV school, because that's another one of our controlled schools where we have eyes on you all the time, and you'll go to a murder board there. And then there'll be a bunch of old guys like me sitting around, and they'll ask you questions you'll probably never have to answer. But our diving... Our shop at SDV2 did 17% of all the diving in the Navy. When you put that submersible in the water, there's a lot that can go wrong, and there's a lot of time spent there. So you would expect them to ask those questions, those diving questions, computerized mixed gas rebreathers, pure O2, subsystems and the submersible. You know, you're going to get those, but you're also going to get what's the range of 7.62, what's the range of this, what's the range of that, what's the procedure for setting a charge, blah 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 blah. So the mortar boards get pretty rough, but I have to honestly say the ones I've sat in on were quite fair. We gave a lot of credit to questions that you needed to know. But the Navy will give you questions on a test that makes no sense. When I was taking the Engineman test, they asked me about a Joe's clutch. They hadn't had a Joe's clutch on a naval vessel since World War I. Why would they ask me that? I think they just asked me to see if I read the book.
in the Air Force, we have the same thing. It's called verification. You go to a murder board and they ask you a bunch of questions that you need to know, some questions that you should know. And then just because everybody needs to squirm up there, some questions that you're not going to know to see how you handle pressure. So yep. It sounds like there's a lot of similarities.
There is. I guess murder boards are the same everywhere.
Yeah. So are you losing people from the end of BUDS to getting to the teams? Because it seems like those are the people that they're never going to quit.
No, we don't lose anybody.
Okay. So you know this is the guy that's going to be a SEAL. We just need to train him up.
Yes. We probably don't know at that point if he's going to be a good SEAL. We think he is. We hope he is. We don't really know. Mostly what we lose people to after they get to the teams is safety-related incidents. You can do something stupid one time, but you can't repeat it. And they will pull your trident or infraction of the law. They'll pull your trident and send you. In some cases, they have court-martialed people. In some cases, they just send them out to the Navy for a two-year period, let them mature a little bit, see what the real world's like, then maybe give them another chance.
It's time out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same thing with being a pilot. Safety and infractions. That our wings are Velcro, so they can rip them off. So, what's it like making it to the teams? You've gone through all this training. Is it exciting? Is it intimidating?
Oh, it starts out a little intimidating. You got all these old war horses, but we're much like the old Navy. We have sea daddies, mentors. Mine was a gentleman named Rex Davis. And it started as we were doing a recall dive, and I was sitting in the boat. I was a safety diver. And there's Rex, right? Rex vibrates like a tuning fork. Hey, boy, can you braid line, splice line? No. He says, ugh. Well, you got a knife? Well, of course, Chief, I'm the safety diver. Don't get smart mouth. Cut me a piece of line. And he sat there and taught me to splice line. One of the handiest things I ever learned in my entire life.
Splicing a line. Can you elaborate on that?
There'll be like three pieces of line, and they'll be on a machine rotating one direction, and then all three of them will rotate a different direction, and line becomes self-locking. But when you tear it apart, and you want to put an eyelet in it, a little loop or something, then you have to figure out how these three lines splice and lay into these others, and you'll end up with a line that needs no knot, because it's basically a Chinese finger trap on three lines inside, internal to another line.
Okay, so it's significantly stronger and doesn't have the weakness of tying
right
two pieces of rope together.
Sailors have been doing it since God wore a size 7.
Okay. So what are your workouts like once you get to the team? Are they individual or are they as a group?
You always have one day where you go on a swim. You always have one day that you always do a combination of PT and runs. On Friday, the runs are long and the PT shorter. On Monday, the swims are long and the PT shorter. One day we'll be in the weight room. And you'll do, I think the Army calls it station training. And so you get so many seconds to set your machine up. And we use machines because you can't be tossing free weights around. Somebody will get hurt. So you get so many seconds to set your machine up, and then you go through a maximum evolution. And then the whistle blows, and you go to the next one. And the runs on Friday... The runs on Friday are actually pretty nice. At least on the East Coast, we jump in a bus, run down to Virginia Beach. We run through the state park and down the boardwalk to Rudy Inlet at the other end of Virginia Beach, about a 10-mile run. And, it's nice. It's the end of the week.
What are your diets like? Are you eating at the mess hall or are you eating on your own?
You're eating on your own. Your diet's whatever your diet is. Now, we have... A lot of our initial training for BUDS came from the French Foreign Legion. You know, when we started out training, finally got together at Fort Pierce, Florida, and started out training, we had Marines and Army, and we had Scouts and Raiders and French Foreign Legion. Somewhere around, 83 or 4, they decided that we should work smarter, not harder. because we have a lot of injuries. Of course, we don't run in tennis shoes. We run in boots and long pants. And, you know, the beaches there are not flat where we run anyway. And we run up and down the sand dunes. And, yeah, you're going to have injuries. But they hired some of the finest sports medicine people in the world, and they put together a SEAL physical fitness guide. So it has one workout routine if you're going Arctic. It has one workout routine if you're going to the jungles, one for the desert. And they even have one called the high mileage SEAL for old guys. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about it is you don't have to guess. They have a formula. You can do a few things and figure out how many reps you should start on and what the weight should be, which is a great starting point. You have to be well-rounded. If you live in a niche environment, and if all you had to do was sniper ops, that's all you had to do, you could concentrate on that 24 hours a day. But if you have to figure out a way to get into a nuclear submarine, up the missile tube, into the dry deck shelter, into the SDV, into the shoreline, across the beach, into the woods, and into a village, You have to be well-rounded. You just can't do, you know, there's just too much stuff. But you don't have to do it on your own. You'll find that ex-SEALs, wait a minute, whoa, let me straighten something out. There are former SEALs, which could have spent 15 minutes in the team or 19 years and 11 months and 29 days. And then there are retired SEALs. I'm a retired SEAL. It's one of those things.
So retired SEAL, you went the 20.
At least.
And you're retired.
20. I thought I went 26, but the Defense Finance Center told me the other month I only spent 25 years, 8 months, and 2 days.
Okay. Jeez, 25 years. That's incredible. Did you get injured very much throughout your training? That sounds like a lot on the body. You guys are like elite athletes.
We have a thing called rock portage. So outside of Coronado, Hotel Del Coronado, one of the most beautiful historic hotels on our country, is a set of big old rocks. And in my class, we had two Korean rock soldiers. One of them could pick up a Volkswagen. One of them could have wrapped himself into a knot. Two very distinctly different guys from the same organization. And we had a little trouble communicating, but the one limber, slim guy was an officer, so he was a coxswain in our boat crew. And what we do is you never know when rock portage is. It's when there's a storm and the waves are crashing in on the rocks. It doesn't matter what time of day it is, they grab you up and they send you out there. That's my impression as a student. So first you have to beat your way out through the surf, then you have to paddle down to the rocks, and then you have to go on the rocks. Well, our coxswain, our Korean coxswain, thought, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. Somebody's going to get hurt. And so as we're paddling in, he's screaming, go beachy, go beachy, because right beside it, there's a beach. And no, we got to go right in there. We got to go in the rocks. But yeah, a lot of people got injured. The wave would knock you out of the boat or flip the boat over, and your foot would go in between the rocks, and the wave would spin you around. We got guys with spiral fractures. Only had to do it one time because our whole boat crew was wiped out. There's only me and Bob left.
Wow. So being in the Navy, being the SEALs for such a long time, did you see patterns emerge on what made a good SEAL and what made a mediocre SEAL?
Sure. Just like you did with pilots. There's no difference. There's more distance between an adequate SEAL and a good SEAL than there is between a good SEAL and a great SEAL. There's a lot more distance in here because every day you have to have a work ethic. Every day you have to show up just like you're working at Singer sewing machine. You have to show up with a smile on your face and you have to be motivated and you have stuff to do. You have to go do that stuff. Now, an adequate SEAL will do it, but he won't do it with the humor and the finesse of a good SEAL. And you get to judge him every day on those things. We have maintenance to do. We have boats and diving rigs and timing devices. And, you know, you got things you have to do. Now, the difference between a good SEAL and a great SEAL is just opportunity and timing. That's very small. You have to be in the right place at the right time. A good ethical person will generally do the right thing when subjected to a stressful situation. Ordinary people do extraordinary things, and extraordinary people do extraordinary things. But none of them do extraordinary things until the situation presents itself. If you daydream and you think, wouldn't it be cool to save a lady from a burning building or something? Maybe you like firemen. If you can daydream that, that situation can present itself. You can have the opportunity to do that. And if you're of the mindset that you would do that, you very well may do that.
So kind of bringing some mental toughness to it and doing some mental preparation.
Oh, it's all mental. I would rather have somebody mentally tough for the long haul than somebody physically tough for the short haul. Now, you may be forced into the fact that we don't always, we embed with other military units and we take people with us, people that know something that we don't know. First thing is make sure you know that you don't know everything.
Yeah.
That's
that
a hard
can be tough.
Yeah, it can be tough.
Some humility.
It really is. But if you're taking somebody in, the reason is they know something you don't know. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. They're a liability otherwise.
So I guess in at least flying, the thing that we find sometimes people struggle with is prioritizing, being able to assess a situation that is not quite what you read in the book, and then prioritizing what's important, what's not, and then executing on what's important. So that's kind of the difference, I guess, between a pretty good pilot and a great pilot. And we try to bridge that gap with the young guys coming in. Is that something that you found to be something that you had to work on with the new guys?
Yeah, I'd say that's an accurate assessment of the military in general. You have already put yourself in a situation. You've already signed a blank check. Now, my life for my country, here's the check. You cash it if you have to. I prefer you don't do that. So you're already in a situation that a good, ethical, hardworking American doesn't find themselves in, generally speaking. There's some guy right now getting up to go work overtime here in Las Vegas that's a good, ethical, honest, trustworthy man. But he didn't sign the check, and he's not likely to find himself looking down the muzzle of an AK.
I guess is what do you guys work on to be able to handle pressure? Because like you said, most people out there don't have to handle really high levels of pressure. And, you know, Navy SEAL, your life is on the line. Is there anything that you guys do as a group to be able to handle pressure, and anything that you did personally to be able to handle pressure well and execute well?
No, in all honesty, Buds is just a stressful situation. You don't let them recover. You don't let them sleep. You're constantly yelling at them. They're constantly having to drop and do push-ups and run and do all kind of crazy crap.
I guess for us, we do a lot of stress inoculation. For instance, we drop live bombs. And even though the switch actuations are the exact same, nothing different, oftentimes you'll see some guys get a little bit of butterflies in their stomach and make a mistake. So I guess that's something that we do as fighter pilots.
I'm a very experienced jumper and rigger. And so I have the opportunity to get ready, get guys ready to go out of the aircraft. So I may have done everything from repair, repack, issue, and do their rigger checks and then put them out the door. And so you get to watch them. Two things I've learned is, a skydive is a skydive. I don't care where you're going. The first thing on your mind is you prioritize. I want to get from this platform to that dirt in one piece. Mm-hmm. All that other minutia, we'll worry about that once I get to the ground. So that stress is almost the same all the time. And then in diving, you know, we dive computerized mixed gas rebreathers and O2 rigs. We don't have much use for air. And those are fairly complicated rigs. And our dives are European in nature, combat swimmer ops. They're long. And then our submersible vehicles, that's a whole different world. And they're wet submersibles. You don't get to sit inside. Mm-hmm.
With a cup of coffee?
No, it doesn't work that way. Yeah, you might be in there using a side scan or something or messing with something, but you're completely wet and completely cold. And we don't use dry suits and we don't use heated suits. And the reason is we lost a young man. He had a Carlton heated suit on, much like the astronauts use under there. Well, when you're into a lengthy transit underwater and you're toasty warm and you get 100 feet past that point of no return, where if your suit malfunctions, you couldn't make it back, and your suit malfunctions, you may not make it back. Due to the temperature, you get hypothermia.
Yeah.
And now you're in a complicated world with hypothermia. That's never good. But if you use a wetsuit, you're never going to get any colder than you are right then. It's as cold as you're going to get. There's no big shock of going from 70 to 46.
Yeah. Oof. It sounds exhausting to be in the cold for a long period of time like that.
Burns massive amounts of calories.
So you being an experienced jumper, you've probably been a lot of halo jumps. Is that correct?
Not a lot. I wouldn't call it a lot. I'm right at a grand for jumps. I spent 4 years in the Navy parachute team. Don't judge me. Somebody has to jump into races and, you know, have a drink and talk to the people. But what we did, the thing in Norm Olson, Captain Olson, just wrote a book about the Navy parachute team. That had nothing to do with military. It has to do how we ushered in the era of the square parachute. When I was young and we went to our first jumps with square parachutes, the engineers told us the line length had to be twice as long as the width of the canopy. So when you're setting up and you set up for your base leg, if you have to make a turn of any kind, you oscillate way out here at the end of this pendulum, and then the canopy rocks. And when the canopy rocks, which is, in your language, a wing, it is a ram air wing. And so you have upper skin and you have a lower skin, and all that area in the middle gets air stuffed in it. Then it builds up a round ball of air and it splits the airstream. So once you dip that leading edge of the wing over, it starts losing altitude. But then you get it back, you know, you get it back straight, face your nose into the wind and land. Well, all of us thought, this is stupid. What do we need all these lines for? So we bought these parachutes, these square parachutes, out of Pinshonka, New Jersey, from Paraflight. And I started cutting lines off. So cut the lines off, and then, I don't want to get too technical, but the front lines were individual lines that came all the way down the risers. Everything else went into the back, which means if you lost a brake, which were evenly spaced across the canopy, you had to literally lift your weight up to get it to flare. When you flare the wing, it changed from a low lift, high lift wing to a high lift, low lift wing. So flare it, bring the nose up and set down. So we did all the research, development, test, and evaluation for the teams on square parachutes. And of course, the West Coast team was probably had the same effort doing the same thing. But we finally cut those 30, 40 feet lines down to 16, 18 feet. Cut the front lines and sewed them into the second set. So we had 50% in the front, 50% in the back.
So they're a little bit more, is it maneuverable? Is that the reason why?
Maneuverable, yes, but it's because maneuverable at low altitudes. Yeah, there are places we jumped, Beaufort, South Carolina, or maybe Beaufort, North Carolina, one of those two. But there's a garrison house, so when you go in, you have to get around the power lines, and then you have to get around the wrought iron fence, and you have to go down the side of the apple tree, and you have to land in between the big rock and the wrought iron fence. The only way to do that is crash it into the ground. You come over it, and you sink it straight down beside the tree, and you just smash it into the ground, and your legs and your ankles and knees have to absorb the shock on that. Normally, if you can set up your legs and come around and get your nose into the wind, you can make a nice landing.
So I guess I'm really fascinated with jumping from high altitude. I guess that halo jump.
Miserable.
Because that's so different than miserable. A civilian jump. What can you just talk me through? Like you're probably in a C-130 or
Yeah, C-130 is wonderful aircraft. I have nothing but praise for the C-130. It could be a C-130. It could be a C-5. We jump C-5s.
Wow.
That's like running out of a garage. But
play some football while you're flying.
Yeah. It's amazing. They can actually make a piece of metal that will get off the ground that big. Yeah. But 141, the old Caribou was a good plane. The old 119 boxcar. It does not matter to a jumper as long as you get to leave the platform. Yeah, but Halo, it's a whole different environment. You can rush to altitude and not suffer from oxygen deprivation and things and get out and get back down to that 15,000-foot level or whatever. But if you're going to do a true Halo jump, you're going to be at some altitude, maybe even 30 grand. And, of course, once they open the bird up and it's not pressurized, you got to find something to breathe. Well, first you have to pre-breathe. And you pre-breathe on oxygen. You bring your partial pressure, O2, up to what the flight surgeon says it should be. And then you leave with nothing but a little bailout bottle, sort of. And you only need to breathe for a short time until you get down there in thicker atmosphere. But it's cold. It's miserable. You wouldn't make a Halo jump if you weren't carrying equipment. Carrying equipment is cold and miserable. And openings are rougher. You know, it's just, it's a real working evolution. It's not, I don't know anybody ever that said, oh boy, we get to make a Halo jump.
Is it, I guess, tactically useful?
No, it has never been tactically useful. The Army came up with it, and they ended up putting out two squads or two platoons so they could reconstitute on the ground, get their fighting force together, have enough redundancy and weaponry and stuff to be able to be an effective unit. Hey-ho will work. Hey-ho, you go out, you jump in a square, for one thing, and we have light panels on top of the parachutes. So when you're setting up your legs to go into wherever you're going, you can actually see a whole set of tail lights running right down the stack because you're stacked up at about a 45-degree angle. And you're stacked up close, or we stack up close. So if the lead guy gets lost, everybody's going to be lost, but they're going to be in the same spot. We'll deal with that once we get on the ground.
Yeah, that's like flying fighters. We go out as a formation. The flight lead is in charge. Everybody follows the flight lead. So hopefully he knows what he's doing. So hey-ho, you jump out really high up. You open up the parachute high, and then you...
Then you glide. You're a glider group.
How far can you glide?
Glide ratio is probably, with equipment, all that crap, is probably 3-1.
Oh, that beats the F-35.
Does it?
Oh, yeah. F-35 sinks like a rock. It's like 1-1.
Well, so you're not actually flying an airplane. You're just flying an engine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If the engine fails and you only got one of them, it's not a good day.
Well, people ask me, why would you jump out of a perfectly good airplane? And I always explain, they wouldn't have parachutes if they were perfectly good airplanes.
Oh, yeah. And we have the ejection seat so that you can punch out.
Oh, as a rigger, I've packed... One of my qualifications, of course, was to pack ejection seats. Now, we had no ejection seats, but that doesn't make any difference to them. So I would have to go over to a loft at a airbase and requal and pack at least a Martin Baker ejection seat. It's a lot of work.
Well, thank you for doing that. That's definitely comforting that I can always punch out of my jet and be safe.
And you know the tradition. If you ever do, you read that rigger's name and make sure you...
Oh, yeah. Definitely owe him a bottle of scotch.
Oh, yeah. We had lots of... In the early years when we were testing the squares, I had 9 malfunctions.
Wow.
The funniest malfunction I ever had. You think malfunctions are going to be bad. They're not. You just go on automatic. But I was supposed to jump into a football game as Santa Claus. And I was going around practicing my ho, ho, ho. And at the end, I'm not sure, probably somebody older than wiser than me knew I was having trouble with my rig, said, no, you can't jump into Santa Claus. So I jumped in. It was at Little Creek, Virginia, at the Naval Amphibious Base. And I opened right over the old SEAL Team 2 area. And we have hand deploys. So I threw my pilot chute out. And nothing happened. So what I've been doing for about six times. As I roll over on my side, I grab that, I pull out by my hand, and I try to beat it before it inflated. Of course, you never can. You get riser burns all over your neck and your face. Well, I rolled over, I grabbed it, I tried to roll back and then pull it out. I lost it. And now I'm running out. I have plenty of airspeed, but I'm running out of altitude rapidly. And so I was going to dump my reserve. And just as I reached in to dump my reserve, my canopy opened. But when I looked down, I was so low that I could actually see the paint flaked on the parking lot.
Wow.
I did one oscillation and sat down on the ground. I was really, really low. So that goes to show you, even experienced guys are stupid sometimes. But the people at the stadium thought I bounced because I got below the tree line from their field of vision. I didn't really get below the tree line, but from where they were standing, it looked like I did. And I came back irritated. They picked me up, took me back to the stadium. So when we got in the truck and we're heading back over to the parachute loft, and our master chief, Pierre Ponson, took my pilot chute and stuck it out the window. And it did not bite. It didn't anchor. And so what we had for throw-out pilot chutes, we had a little pilot chute, and then we pulled the center down with an umbilical cord, and that gave it a very shallow, rapid fill. Then it acts as an anchor, and then you fall away from it, and it pulled everything out. Well, my umbilical cord in the middle was too far, so the airflow was hitting the sides and just running off of it. Sometimes it would catch, sometimes it wouldn't.
Jeez.
That's probably my weirdest malfunction.
So I guess going back to the hey-ho jump, so that is a more tactically useful thing? So you could jump high and then just glide into
target? In my humble opinion, it is a tactically sound feat, depending on the adversary. No tactic works in every situation. Mm-hmm. But Halo works in almost no situation, including training. Now, if they had proven it in training, they didn't have to double up. You know, not everybody can afford to double up on their manpower to accomplish one task. I mean, that's...
Do you have to double up your manpower for that?
For Halo.
Okay.
Because they couldn't get that A-team, because primarily the A-teams were doing it, you couldn't get that A-team into one field. They were scattered. Okay. They were using
rounds. Because you couldn't glide all together and stay in formation.
And it may be a tactically sound tactic now, because sometimes you just have to wait until technology catches up with your tactic. Now, assuming they're now jumping square parachutes, they have probably better oxygen gear than we had, has far fewer malfunctions, and then it may be a tactically sound tactic. Never say never, because there's no such thing as never.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, we have the same issues. Oftentimes it takes years and years for technology to catch up to these tactics that sound good on paper, but they really don't work out well. So you just kind of have to play a waiting game with that. Well, Monty, I think that's about all the time we have. I really want to thank you for doing this interview. It means a lot to me, and hopefully other people will get some information out of this.
Thank you very much.
All right, guys, this has been the Professionals Playbook. I'm Justin Lee. If you know of any other great guests, email me, justin@professionalsplaybook.com. Also try to answer any questions that you guys have. Ways to support the show are 1, write a review on iTunes, 2, click subscribe, and 3, share it on social media. You can also check out the website at professionalsplaybook.com. That's all I got. See you guys next week.